Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and coming up, could workers from the Pacific offer a solution to Australia's aged care crisis? Fears that the state is taking over the higher education sector in Papua New Guinea, and soccer joy in Honiara.
Yes, lovely one, and that's after all his efforts to find a goal. He's done it.
More on some soccer history in Solomon Islands later in the programme. But first, the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has signalled his country's desire to deepen ties with Samoa following talks with Prime Minister Tuilepe Soilihi in Beijing. As one of the first Pacific Island countries to establish diplomatic links with China, Mr. Li stressed that his government attaches great importance to developing its relationship with Samoa further. For his part, Prime Minister Tuilepe is a big fan of China's international development strategy, known as the Belt and Road Initiative. But when China's influence in the Pacific is seen as a cause for concern by other nations, including Australia, what's the view in Samoa? Well, the links between the country and China are probably the most well-established in the Pacific, and the editor of the Samoa Observer, Kenny Lasar, says although the country has a lot of donor and development partners, China is widely viewed as number one on the list.
Well, they are the best of friends. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's been suggested in some circles that Samoa is becoming a mini China. And, you know, looking at what's happening today, that's exactly what we see. Keep in mind that all the stuff that China's doing, we always say that there's no such thing as free lunch. And, you know, we're getting so much lunch at the moment, somebody's got to pay.
In cash terms, the Lowy Institute's recent report on overseas aid ranks China in second place behind Australia. But Jonathan Pryke, who leads the Institute's Pacific Islands program, says China aid symbols are a familiar site in Apia and beyond, so it makes perfect sense for the Samoan government to jump on board China's Belt and Road Initiative.
The BRI really is a PR tool to encapsulate all of the activity that China has been engaged in around the world, is to try and package it, give it a strategic bent. And the reality is that in the Pacific, the Chinese state-owned enterprises were well ahead of China's diplomatic efforts in the region. And it makes sense now as diplomacy is catching up that they'll want to pull all of these activities that China is engaged in the region under this global banner of the Belt and Road Initiative.
So could Prime Minister Tuilepe Soilihi become China's standard bearer in the Pacific, spruiking the benefits of Belt and Road? Matthew Dornan, Deputy Director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University, doesn't think so.
Samoa clearly is one of China's darlings, I guess, in the Pacific. What the Samoan Prime Minister did say very clearly at his speech in Sydney the other week was that these decisions should be made by Pacific Island governments. I didn't see him trying to convince other Pacific Island countries that recognise Taiwan to shift across to China.
One thing is for sure, aid from China is playing a vital role in Samoa's development. Beijing is funding the building of a much-needed police academy, and without Chinese funds, Kenny Lasar says the Pacific Games Council could not have turned to Samoa as emergency hosts when Tonga bailed out of the 2019 Pacific Games.
Samoa has taken the Pacific Games at very short notice, and there's only one way they've been able to do that, and that's through the Chinese, because the Chinese are stepping up and they've signed up all the contracts and they said, we'll fund this, we'll fund that.
But Lowy's aid report estimates that 60% of the aid China has put into Samoa has come in the form of loans, and Kenny Lasar says crunch time has arrived and the government's starting to feel the pinch.
That's already happening with this new law to tax the church ministers. It's a very controversial issue. It's been a debate that's been going for a while, so that definitely is the case. And I think more and more people will wake up and say, oh, actually, this wasn't a free lunch after all.
In light of the recent concerns over China's ambitions in the Pacific, Australia's new assistant minister for the region, Anne Ruston, may have taken some of the heat out of the situation by stating that her government has no problem with Chinese aid in the region, provided it's based on the priorities of the island nations. But the Lowy Institute's Jonathan Pryke says aid is still only part of the story.
There is still definitely a degree of anxiety that comes back to just what is the strategic intent of China in the Pacific. If it is to inevitably set up a military presence in the Pacific region, well, that's of great concern to the Australian and New Zealand government. The pace at which China are ramping up their engagement in the region indicates that it's more than something that's just benign.
That's Jonathan Pryke, who heads up the Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program, reflecting on Samoa's burgeoning relationship with China. Now, the Australian government's decision to set up a royal commission into the aged care sector coincided with the results of a major ABC investigation, with aged care workers telling their stories of how elderly and vulnerable Australians are suffering because nursing homes are acutely understaffed. Workers in the sector have detailed many cases of neglect and abuse. And with Australia's ageing population growing, it's feared the situation will only get worse, with estimates suggesting as many as 1.3 million care workers will be needed by 2050. So where will those workers come from? Well, as Catherine Grau reports, a recent study from the World Bank is backing the idea that workers from Pacific Island countries could help Australia to solve their problem.
Help! Captured by a camera hidden by her son, this elderly woman was left crying out for help to get out of her bed in her nursing home.
Finally, 3 hours after she woke, two carers returned to get her out of bed.
This story was one of many revealed in what was the ABC's biggest ever crowdsourced investigation, with the audience invited to share their experiences of the aged care industry. More than 4,000 people responded, and more than a quarter of them were from within the sector.
There was myself and a registered nurse in charge of 72 residents.
You'd see staff members just quickly go in, offer the resident a bit of food, and if they didn't take it immediately, just go out and ditch the lunch.
Migrants currently make up 40% of the existing workforce in Australia. They come mostly from the Philippines, India and Nepal. But now the industry and the Australian government are being urged to look closer to home. Economist Jesse Doyle co-authored the World Bank's new report.
Clearly, I mean, the Pacific is not 100% of the solution, but it's certainly a core part of the solution. Aged care providers really struggling to bring in both low-skilled and skilled workers domestically. But we've heard from the peak aged care industry bodies in Australia and New Zealand, Pacific Islanders could be brought across and then skilled up with on-the-job training.
Anoni Sisa Fafita took part in a pilot program 4 years ago at the Aho Panilolo Technical Institute in Tonga.
It's part of our culture to care for our aged. But we also know through that learning experience for me the need for a professional knowledge.
That pilot course, though, funded by the Australian government, was never continued. There are now plans at another Tongan Vocational Institute to give it a go. Reverend Dr. Unigata Kata is the director of the Tupou Tertiary Institute, which is applying for funding to help it offer aged care certificates from next year.
We will start small. Because we are a small institution, we want to start next year with about 20 students.
But given the concerns within the Australian aged care sector about unqualified staff, there is pressure on those in the Pacific to ensure they meet the required standards. Reverend Dr. Unigata Kata says that's an issue they're acutely aware of.
Our challenge now is basically a trainer. So we have to train our own trainers to be able to train more trainers so that the program can expand. You just can't send a whole group of people to do aged care when they have not had any training. They don't understand the nuances of a different culture, of different legal requirements. Absolutely a backlash if the training does not happen.
But it's going to be some time before graduates are ready to work in Australia, and many more training courses will need to be set up if the Pacific is to produce the kinds of numbers Australia's aged care sector will need in coming decades. Economist Jesse Doyle says for the short term, the Australian government's new Pacific Labour Scheme will act as a trial. It's going to allow 2,000 people from 6 Pacific countries now to come work in a range of industries, including aged care, for up to 3 years.
As we saw with the seasonal worker program, it started off as a program that was capped very modestly for the first couple of years, and then very quickly the caps expanded and ultimately the cap was removed. So I think the way to look at this scheme is if it's successful and if it meets the demands and needs of Australian employers and also provides the right set of opportunities for Pacific Islanders, if it has buy-in on both sides, then it's a program that could definitely be scaled very quickly, particularly if we continue to see these labour shortages in the aged care sector.
World Bank economist Jesse Doyle ending that report from Catherine Grau. You're listening to Pacific Review with me, Richard Ewart. The former Vice-Chancellor of Papua New Guinea's University of Technology, Albert Schramm, claims there was an orchestrated campaign to have him removed from his post at a time when the institution had been given a clean bill of financial health for the first time in 2 decades. The case against him was triggered by an accusation that he had falsified his qualifications, and although the allegation was eventually dismissed by the National Court, Dr. Schramm decided that his position had become untenable. More recently, Dr. John Warren resigned from his post as Vice-Chancellor at the University of Natural Resources and the Environment in Rabaul, amid claims that he had been threatened with arrest after the Chancellor, Kenneth Sumbuk, accused him of spreading false rumours. The Higher Education Secretary, Father Jan Schuber, has told Pacific Beat that both are isolated cases and there is no campaign to remove outspoken foreign academics. But Dr. Schramm, who's now back in his home city of Verona in Italy, insists his experience and that of Professor Warren are symptoms of a broader government move to exert control over PNG's leading academic institutions.
In my case, it's the same story. Actually, in November 2017, for the first time in over two decades, the Papua New Guinea University of Technology managed to get an independent audit report for all its accounts, which was unqualified, which means it's clean. But it's not about performance. It's about how much you know and how much you favor the independence of the universities. And government doesn't like that. In fact, another decision that was taken was to abolish the student representative councils. By a fluke, John Warren's university still had an SRC, but very small. But the two main universities in Port Moresby and Lae, they are now without a student representation for the first time in history.
So clearly, from the way you describe them, it would seem to me that these are changes that nobody was really asking for.
Exactly. You put the finger on the spot. The independent review of the university system, which was commissioned by the Somare government and the Rudd government in Australia, never said that the vice-chancellor's appointment needed to be approved by the government or that the SRCs had to be abolished. So what we're seeing now is a university model which is no longer Western. This is becoming a Chinese university model where the government controls everything. I'm afraid that there is a trend where, you know, the politicization of universities is now a fact. And basically, you cannot do your job in those circumstances. So I hope there will be another government after 2022, and I will be able to return to visit my many friends and former students. But unfortunately, I'm in exile now.
The Higher Education Secretary, Father Jan Schuber, said during the course of an interview that I conducted with him a week or so ago, Albert Schramm is welcome back in Papua New Guinea any time that he produces the documentation.
Father John, I know him well. He is in a difficult position. He is trying to do the right thing. And of course, formally, he is right. But the reality of the situation is that I managed to annoy a few people, just a few, in very high-ranking positions who are adamant that I should be kept out of the country. And they have been screaming that over the phone to Father John. At that point, there is not much I can do, but I'm really sorry because I was just getting started. The finances were sorted out, the efficiency of the operations, the procurement and personnel management needed to be sorted out. So there was still a lot of work left to do. And I also pursued quite an active internationalization strategy, trying to rebuild the reputation of the University of Technology. But now with my unlawful arrest and wrongful dismissal, that credibility now is in tatters. So I think Father John is being too optimistic if he thinks that myself, or for that matter, any other foreigner, will return to serve the university students of Papua New Guinea.
Dr. Albert Schramm, former vice-chancellor of Unitec in Papua New Guinea, talking to Pacific Review from his home in Verona in Italy. The government of Solomon Islands has launched a national survey to find out how big the country's growing population of saltwater crocodiles actually is. The reptiles are protected under an international conservation treaty, but in the wake of an increasing number of crocodile attacks, some of them fatal, the government may find it has some hard decisions to make in future, as Evan Wasuka reports.
In recent years, the saltwater crocodile has brought fear to many communities across Solomon Islands. Dr. Matthew Brown is a crocodile expert.
It's the largest species of crocodile in the world. The males can get up to around 5 or 6 metres and around a ton in weight. They are responsible for a number of attacks throughout their range, and Solomon Islands is no different. So over the last 10 years, there appears to be a large number of attacks on people. And so it is really important to be able to manage this species because it is dangerous to people.
Dr. Brown has been in Honiara as part of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature Specialist Group to provide advice to the government on its national survey of crocodile numbers.
It's very challenging to do standard boat surveys in places like the Solomons that have so many remote islands. So their approach to this issue is very innovative, and I believe they've got some very good data that should help inform upcoming management programs and anything else that the government decides to do.
In Solomon Islands, saltwater crocodiles are protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, known as CITES. That means no hunting and definitely no trade in crocodiles. The survey is providing opportunity for the government to consider its options, with the trade in crocodiles an attractive opportunity. John Lever is an Australian crocodile farmer based in Queensland. In the 1970s, while working for the Commonwealth Scientific, Industrial and Research Organization, he helped to set up crocodile farms in Papua New Guinea. He says Solomon Island's best option lies in crocodile parks or tourist facilities, rather than in crocodile skins, due to a lower number of the reptiles.
Well, everybody likes to see really big crocodiles. And so being able to go out and catch crocodiles alive and then put them in a facility where people can actually see these large crocodiles and see the feeding, I think that's an important aspect. And the other thing that people really like to see is baby crocodiles. If you actually get to the stage where you're getting your captive breeders actually breeding and laying eggs, fertile eggs, and the eggs hatching out, then an exciting time for all is to see the babies hatching out of eggs.
While the government and communities may be keen to use the country's stock of crocodiles and start up an industry, they'll need to work through the procedures of CITES to lift the ban on harvesting and trade. CITES will be meeting in May next year in Sri Lanka, where global members will consider all proposals, including Solomon Islands one. Joe Horoko, the Director of Environment, says his department will use the information from the survey to present to CITES a comprehensive report covering crocodile numbers and a management plan.
It's not easy for us to convince other big members of the CITES, because CITES not only invite party states, but also members of the NGOs. They also played quite an influential role in how CITES deliberate. The good thing is we have experts who are working with us on this. I think we can be able to make a good representation so that people can get some money benefit from our crocodile.
Solomon Islands would have to convince CITES that crocodiles can be sustainably harvested, stocks can be monitored and protected to get the saltwater crocodile removed from the list of endangered species.
Evan Wasuka reporting there. I'm Richard Ewart and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The Fijian word bulla translates as life and is a commonly used greeting throughout the country and around the Pacific. It's an intrinsic part of Fijian culture. So when news filtered back to the islands that an American bar owner had trademarked the word, there was a backlash on social media. And now, as Nick Fogarty reports, a petition has been launched accusing the US businessmen of cultural appropriation.
Kava bars are seeing something of a boon in the United States, and one of them, based in Florida, is called Bulla on the Beach. Last year, the owner of that particular bar, Ross Kashtan, applied to trademark the word bulla, and just a couple of weeks ago, it was officially registered in the US trademark database. Some people, such as Fijian anthropologist Dr. Teresi Vunadillo, are not happy.
First of all, I was quite upset and quite shocked at the same time, given that a person who is not of Fijian heritage, who may not maybe even have an inkling of what the word means, and is using this word, which is so important to us Fijians, in a commercial setting.
Dr. Vunadillo says she contacted the bar as soon as she heard the news, but hasn't received a response. She's also started a petition to fight the trademark. In it, bar owner Ross Kashtan is accused of having appropriated the word bulla, with which he has no personal connection, for purely commercial purposes. When the ABC called Bulla on the Beach to ask for their thoughts on the backlash, we were told by staff to put our queries in writing, but these went unanswered. Further inspection of the US trademark database, though, reveals that the bar in question isn't even the first business to trademark the word. Bulla, on its own and combined with other words, has been trademarked at least 43 times in the US for goods and services such as stuffed toys and healthcare regulatory compliance consulting. It's also been trademarked multiple times in Australia, including for bar services. Fiji-based business lawyer John Apted has examined the details of this latest trademark and says its scope is fairly restricted.
It's only trademarked for bars and cafes that serve coffee, liquor, sake, juice and kava. The registration is limited to the US, so it doesn't affect anybody outside of the US who's not running a bar or a cafe.
John Apted says people should recognise these limits on the trademark when making up their minds about its significance.
I think, with all due respect, many people are overreacting. This isn't a case like traditional knowledge of a herbal cure that somebody's trying to make money off, like a big pharmaceutical company. Bulla is a word. Everybody's allowed to use it. And like any word, people can make money off it. And that's all he's doing. He's making money off a word, just like many of us do. And he's created a brand, and he's trying to protect his brand.
Earlier this year, a similar fight erupted over the use of the Hawaiian greeting Aloha. Chicago-based restaurant chain Aloha Poke trademarked the word Aloha and sent cease and desist letters to Alaska-based Hawaiian family business Aloha Poke Shop, ordering it to change its name. It triggered calls for a boycott of the Chicago company. And in PNG this year, investigations were launched into the passing off of Chinese-made billum bags as being locally made. In a similar vein, Fijian anthropologist Teresi Vinadillo says she's protesting out of respect for traditional language.
We are not here to say negative things about his business venture, but it's just basically the process of respect. Even for those who have trademarked Mbula before, you know, whatever establishment that they represent, the question is that goes to them, have they actually consulted any Fijian or any organization, or maybe through the Fiji Embassy in Washington, D.C., some sort of action that shows that they have some decency and some respect for our Fijian language.
Fijian anthropologist Teresi Vunindilo ending that report by Nick Fogarty. Finally, in this edition of Pacific Review, the best young male soccer players in Solomon Islands have written their names into the history books. They're on their way to the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Peru next year, after defeating Pacific rivals Fiji by 3-1 at the semi-final stage of the OFC Under-16 Championship in Honiara.
Final whistle of the game. The Solomon Islands players on the bench, out on the field as well, celebrating their qualification to the FIFA World Cup next year.
Players and fans alike went wild with celebration at Lawson Tama Stadium as Solomon Islands clinched a place at a FIFA World Cup for the very first time, and no one celebrated harder or with more emotion than William Lai, the president of the Solomon Islands Football Federation.
We are a football mad nation, and this dream is no longer a dream. We win, it's a relief, it's a happiness. The emotion is so much. Those people support football. They feel the same thing. They are very happy.
Equally proud was technical director Felipe Vega Aranjo, deployed by FIFA to assist with soccer development in the Solomons.
A lot of them, actually, they were playing village football several months ago. So I think it's going to take a few days to sink in. We try to keep them focused, but imagine, they are teenagers, they are children. So at the same time, they are making history at such a young age. So imagine how they feel.
With a year to go now before the Under-17 World Cup kicks off, the hope is the excitement surrounding the build-up for the Solomons boys will attract new sponsors and bring some much-needed extra finance into the game.
Well, that's what we hope. And maybe through this, we find support for the government and other stakeholders, and it gives some hope to the youth because they are talented people, they are really nice people, they work really hard, and they deserve to have an opportunity.
I believe that from now on, we as a nation, the leaders, the politicians, to give more funding opportunity for the young generation of football players in this country.
The Pacific representatives at the last Under-17 World Cup, New Zealand and New Caledonia, acquitted themselves well, with each side managing a draw against more highly fancied nations in Turkey and Japan. So while the going will be tough for Solomon Islands, Felipe Vega Aranjo says it's a wonderful chance to showcase their talents.
The best teams in the world are going there, but it's a wonderful challenge, a wonderful opportunity, and I hope the preparation of the team is the right one.
And the technical director who has guided the development of the Under-16 squad says there are some gems who he believes have what it takes to make it in the professional game.
Especially there are two players. They are extremely focused, they are extremely fast, they are extremely competitive, and the only thing that they need is an opportunity, because they have been 5 months right now training with proper coaching. So imagine that these kids can have proper coaches through the year and proper competition. You never know, but I have to have a hope.
Two against two here. Charles Murray running for space. He goes to his left-hand side. Yes, lovely one. And that's after all his efforts to find a goal. He's done it. Rafael Leai.
A fabulous achievement for the Solomon Islands boys, and further adventures lie ahead at the Under-17 World Cup in South America next year. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. For weekly highlights from the Pacific, do subscribe to our podcast. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.